Probably most people don't have much control over what's going on in their mind. Things just pop up. Thoughts, memories, and emotions, lots of emotions. Some may be positive or virtuous, but probably a lot of the emotions that come up are not so positive and maybe even very negative, very non-virtuous. And this happens without much choice. We don't really choose what comes up in our mind. So it's almost like we're helpless about that. But it doesn't have to be that way. The Buddha's teachings show us that we can have more choice, more control over what goes on in our mind. And try to have more positive, constructive, happy, and virtuous states of mind, thoughts, and emotions. And to have fewer unhappy, disturbing, negative thoughts and emotions in our mind. But first, we have to be able to differentiate which types of emotions are positive, which are negative. And then the teachings contain a lot of methods, very practical methods, to decrease the negative states of mind, like anger, greed, selfishness, and so on, and increase the positive ones, the virtuous ones, like compassion, love, joy, faith, and so forth. So we can do this ourselves. And one of the ways we often do it is by generating a positive motivation before we start doing something, whether it's washing dishes or doing prostrations or listening to teachings. So we already did that earlier today and several times during the day. So let's do it again to make sure that our being here tonight will be as positive and beneficial and meaningful as possible. So just do that on your own. Bring into your mind your positive motivation and make that your reason for being here and participating in this class. So we've been going through the mental factors, and last week we started looking at the virtuous mental factors. There's 11 of those, and last week we managed to get through the first six, which are faith, integrity, consideration for others, and the three nons: non-attachment, non-hatred, non-confusion. Yeah. So what I'd like to do tonight is look at the remaining five virtuous mental factors, then just look at virtue and non-virtue in general, to understand what those are all about, and then see if we have time to move on to the next group of mental factors, which are afflictions, the root afflictions, starting with attachment. I think it'd be really useful to talk about attachment. And I sent a file today via Venerable Tsepel with some notes, because the original set of notes that I made a couple months ago for this class were very scanty when it came to the last few groups of mental factors, so I sent some additional material. Okay, so the next mental factor is number seven, joyous effort. And we hear about this in the perfections, the six perfections. That's number four. Okay, so what His Holiness says is, it counteracts laziness and joyfully engages in constructive actions. Constructive meaning virtue. So that's really the essence of joyous effort, is being happy to engage in virtue, being, you know, tireless, wanting to do virtue as much as possible. And happy about it, not like it's a burden, it's a job, something I have to do, but really joyfully. And then it says, it acts to generate constructive qualities that have not been generated and to bring those that have to completion. So there's some more information from Geshe Rabten's book, Mind and Its Functions. Here he calls it enthusiasm. So that's another way that some translators, sometimes they call it enthusiastic perseverance or effort or joyous effort. So there's lots of different ways of translating it. Okay, so, He says, all the wholesome aspects of the path are developed by means of enthusiasm, joyous effort. It is through its activating force that liberation and Buddhahood are realized. Enthusiasm is the dynamic quality of mind necessary to effectively accomplish any spiritual growth and understanding. When a hillside of dry grass catches fire, the blaze will only spread if there is sufficient wind. That's probably a very relevant example here. If there's no wind, it might just die out. But likewise, the fire of intelligent discrimination, I guess that's wisdom, will only be able to burn away the afflictions if it is sufficiently stirred by the wind of enthusiasm. Otherwise, no matter how much intelligent comprehension one has attained, it will only be wasted if it is not joyously and enthusiastically applied in practical meditation. So even if you have some wisdom, but if you're lazy, you don't work to increase your wisdom and use your wisdom to clear away the afflictions, then it's kind of a waste. Since there are three types of laziness, we can also distinguish three forms of enthusiasm that act as a remedy for them. The first kind of laziness is that of idleness or sloth. Sloth or sloth? Sloth. Sloth. Like that animal. This is a dull quality of mind that lacks any interest in Dharma and simply wishes to sink into an indifferent state of sleepiness. So that's the usual, what people would normally think of as laziness. The second laziness is that of self-pity. Sometimes it's called the laziness of discouragement. This becomes manifest in thoughts such as, I am so inferior that I could never attain any insight or liberation. So I wonder sometimes, because they don't really have a term, I haven't come across a term in Buddhism for depression. And this is the closest thing that I've come to. It's like you just think, I'm so lousy, I'm so hopeless, I'm a failure, I could never do anything, I could never get anywhere, I could never change myself. So kind of self-deprecation, self-hatred. And it's a kind of laziness, because if we really think that way, we won't even try. What's the use of trying? It won't work anyway. So you just end up being really morose and depressed and sunk into yourself. He says, it is a needless indulgence based on a deprecation or depreciation? Oh, depreciation of one's own potential. The third type of laziness, attraction to evil, I don't like that word evil very much, but anyway, is often confused with enthusiasm, since it too is characterized by perseverance, but perseverance towards that which is unwholesome. All efforts we make towards accomplishing worldly goals, even when they are joyfully undertaken, are in fact a form of laziness. So, you know, people have a lot of effort to make money, to succeed in their career, to go, you know, skiing and snowboarding and surfing and jumping out of airplanes and all, I mean, amazing things that people do with their energy. But if those things are done just for the sake of this life, for pleasure, for fame, for money, for whatever, just thinking in terms of this life, then from the point of view of Buddhism, that's just laziness. Okay. Okay, so then there's different types of joyous effort that counteract these. An awake, diligent state of mind is the enthusiasm that counteracts idleness or sloth. So that's one kind of joyous effort, having a very awake and diligent state of mind. And then second is a wholesome perseverance based on self-confidence is the enthusiasm that overcomes self-pity. Okay, so we need self-confidence, which is not the same as pride or arrogance. So we're not, you know, feeling we are above others, looking down on others, but we are just confident in our abilities and our qualities and our potential. Everybody has the potential to change, to become liberated, to become enlightened. So recognizing and having confidence in our good qualities, in our potential, being happy about that and working to develop those. So that's the second kind of enthusiasm or joyous effort. And the third is a wholesome perseverance. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, no, I've read that already. The third is, and the finding of joy in what is wholesome is the enthusiasm that eliminates attraction to evil. Okay, so three kinds of laziness, three kinds of joyous effort. So we do have this quality already to a certain extent. I'm sure we all feel happy sometimes to do meditation or other practices or doing work for the Abbey and so on and so forth. But this can be cultivated even more. You know, there's always room for improvement because we probably all have laziness sometimes. So how can we cultivate more joyous effort? What are some ways?
Setting a motivation, thinking about something, what is the meaning of my life that could encourage us, or developing some compassion too.
Yeah, I think the meditation on the precious human life is really, really very helpful, you know, to realize we have this precious opportunity. We can do so much good with it. It's not going to last forever. And who knows what's going to happen next, you know, when this life ends. So, you know, thinking about that, contemplating that can give us a lot of energy to engage in virtue and make good use of our life, use our life well and meaningfully. Any other ideas how we can have more joyous effort?
Contemplating the benefits of the practice, both the temporal benefits now and the ultimate benefits for ourselves and for others.
Mm, yeah.
And rejoicing in that.
Yeah. Seeing the good results that will come from engaging in practice, meditation, prostration, purification, accumulating merit, study, and so forth. Seeing the benefits of good deeds, virtuous deeds. Also, the faults of non-virtue, we don't do virtue, and if we instead do non-virtue, what will happen? What will be the consequences of that? I think that's really helpful.
Looking up to people who do a lot of good things with their time, and being around people who also enjoy doing good things.
Yeah, yeah. We do pick up on... It's like the influence of others. So if you're around people who have joyous effort, it's easy to go along with that, feel that way too. If you're around people who are depressed, who are lazy, complaining all the time, then, you know, that those kind of qualities might come out in you as well. Venerable Sankey.
What helps me sometimes is to not be so, happy and high and then get discouraged easily. There's something about steadfastness, something about just kind of not plugging along, but continually just trying to make some movement forward, you know, trying to cultivate what I can and decrease what I can't, but to be really constant about it and not be really on fire about things and then sort of back off and sort of space out. So to get some constancy in my practice, that seems to help the joy part of the effort, because I don't have unrealistic expectations, and it seems to help a little bit getting it more realistic, you know.
Yeah, I've heard the lamas talk about the kind of pace to have in our practice. They say it's best to be like an elephant, because an elephant is a really large animal, and it walks slowly most of the time, I think, but it can go a really long time. It keeps going at the same pace, and it can go like all day and very far. So we should be like that rather than like a rabbit who kind of runs here that way and then stops and goes back another way and then stops and, you know, just very, I don't know what the word for that is, but inconsistent, and you don't get anywhere that way. So yeah, like they say, sometimes practitioners are like that. You know, you put in a lot of effort one day and you do lots and lots of meditation. Next day you're completely exhausted and you sleep all day, or you stop meditating for a month and then start again. You know, so that kind of way of practicing doesn't work very well. So yeah, it's better to have this consistent and steady and not so fast, not too fast, not too slow, but kind of a medium pace at one's level, because everyone's different. So we also need to avoid comparing ourselves with other people. So there might be somebody who has a huge amount of effort and energy and able to do lots and lots and lots of things. And then we think, oh, I have to be like that. But maybe we can't. So we can rejoice in what that person is doing, but also know our own abilities and practice according to that.
Leah, I'm working with catching when I'm losing this kind of joyous effort. It's because certain thoughts arise, you know, going into the future and thinking, oh, in 10 minutes I have to be there, instead of just saying, oh, right now I'm enjoying what I'm doing here. These 10 minutes are great. So, yeah, catching the thoughts.
Being the present.
Being present.
I've also heard this called the joy, the effort of joy. And when we're joyful, we have more effort. We have more energy. And so I think about just practices that bring up joy in general, such as remembering the kindness of others, seeing how we can do the things that we do with the motivation of benefiting others can be joyful. Just keeping a joyful mind. Joy is something that we can cultivate. I remember thinking about SOG at one point and not really knowing what it was about. Just thinking, well, it's a celebration. I can just rejoice. And I was able to just have a joyful mind.
Yeah, that's really important too, because if our mind does go into depression and seeing the faults of ourself, the faults of others, and so on, and just very negative, then it is hard to have this quality of joyful effort. So if we have joy, virtuous joy, positive joy in the right things, then, yeah, naturally that does bring more effort. I think Venerable Tarpa had a Tarpa, and then Amsel, and then Matt. I said, okay.
So in what we've talked about so far, we've actually covered these four things that Shanti Deva talks about. I think he talks about aspiration, steadfastness, joy, and rest. As these conditions or aspects, things, and we've talked about the first four, but I'm wondering if you, what you think about the rest one. I find that it's good to have a space between things, kind of like to recharge and to, I don't know, the mind just naturally needs these kind of breaks so that then you can be refreshed. I think of it as refreshing.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you have thoughts.
Yeah,
about
he doesn't. I think in the traditional teachings, there's not a huge amount of explanation about that one. He just says the bodhisattva will sometimes realize the need to take a break. So I just think that's up to each person. Mm-hmm. Each person, you need to know yourself, your body, your mind, your abilities. And you probably have to come to this by making mistakes, mm-hmm. pushing yourself too hard and then realizing, okay, that doesn't work. And then maybe also going the other way and being too lazy. So you kind of, that's the way I think of it. You sort of go back and forth for a while, and then at some point you'll find that middle way, that middle place, a balanced way of doing it. That's how I think of it.
So. Someone online has commented about getting enough rest and eating the right food to properly prepare our bodies for what we're going to be doing.
Yeah.
Super mundane note, just if we are in a mood where we're not joyous, and smiling, it does help, even if it's kind of forced. Also, I've heard the Dalai Lama advise...
You say it helps to force? Is that what
you're saying? Yeah, if you force a smile, then, you know, it loosens the attitude and you can start to get to a more genuine smile afterwards.
Yeah, actually, Venerable Chunyi gave a BBC talk on that one day recently. Maybe you weren't here, but yeah, research shows, yeah, even just forcing yourself to smile, it does do something physiologically, isn't it? Yeah, and it does help you to feel better. Yeah.
And I was also saying that, I wasn't saying, the Dalai Lama was saying that belly laughs help.
Belly laugh. Yeah, he certainly does a lot of that.
Lastly, I've been working with a lot of crankiness lately after my mid-afternoon naps. And just recognizing that the reason I'm cranky is not because of the other people, and it's really just the afflictions that are just kind of resting there. And realizing that beneath that is still going to be some sort of joyous effort, and that I can go back to that if I deal with the afflictions.
Sorry, that last bit was a little too fast. What did you say?
I know that right beneath the afflictions is not necessarily joyous effort, but getting rid of the afflictions there and suppressing them and dealing with them first is a good way to get to the joyous effort that's underneath.
Yeah, for sure. If there's anger or irritation or whatever afflictions going on in the mind, then we need to take care of those. Otherwise, we're just suppressing or pushing, denying. And then it's probably not really joyous effort. It's probably just forcing ourselves, maybe not for the right reason. Okay, so let's move on. The next one, number 8, is pliancy. And sometimes it's translated as flexibility. In Geshe Repton's book, suppleness. So this enables the mind to apply itself to a constructive object in whatever manner it wishes and dissipates any mental or physical tightness or rigidity. So this is talked about in the context of calm abiding. When you probably heard teachings on calm abiding and tried your luck at practicing calm abiding. So there's a pliancy, actually. Well, sometimes it sounds like, you know, it only arises with calm abiding. And that's one of the signs of calm abiding, when you have physical and mental pliancy. But in the book about calm abiding by Genlam Rinpa, if I remember correctly, I haven't looked at it for a while, but he said that actually pliancy can start, little bit of pliancy can start arising even with the first of the 9 stages. Yeah. And so I thought that, I found that really helpful to understand that you start getting little tastes of this right from the beginning, and then it increases as you progress, and finally at the 9th stage, or after the 9th stage of calm abiding, then you know, the full force of it comes. Okay, so so Geshe Repton says, so this is the antidote to mental and physical rigidity. So that is an inept state of mind or body in which one is incapable of doing what one wishes. It is a seed that gives rise to all forms of afflictions. So we probably sometimes have this thought, I should do things, I should meditate, I should practice, I should go and help people, I should do something useful. But we just can't get ourselves moving, right? We just sit there or lie there, you know, and can't get it together. Or mentally, yeah, also mentally, you know, we're just not able to direct our mind in the way we would like to, in the way we feel it would be useful. Excuse me. So this mental factor, pliancy, overcomes any heaviness and rigidity and makes the mind very flexible and quick. One is thus enabled to use the mind in whatever way one wishes, whether to solve an intellectual problem or to concentrate upon an object of meditation. Through practice, this quality can also be developed in the body, giving one a sense of extreme physical lightness and well-being, as though one were floating in air. The suppleness of body, however, is only a specific form of tactile sensation and not to be considered as the wholesome mental factor of suppleness. Likewise, it should be noted that suppleness or pliancy only refers to the supple quality of mind that refers to wholesome objects. So it's only when we're dealing with wholesome objects and not with something unwholesome, like wanting to rob a bank or wanting to win a marathon or something that's not necessarily virtuous. So in regard to doing things that are virtuous, such as developing our mind, developing calm abiding, that's when this mental quality comes into play. So in the teachings on calm abiding, there are various obstacles that one has to deal with and get out of the way to make progress. And the first obstacle is laziness. And in this case, laziness means I don't want to meditate. I don't feel like meditating. You know, you just don't have the interest, the wish, the energy to practice. That specific kind of laziness. So to overcome this kind of laziness, it's said that the real antidote is pliancy, this mental factor. Once you get pliancy, there's no more laziness. You're just happy to meditate. You could meditate for days, for weeks, for months. You're not getting bored or tired of it. But how do we get that? How do we get that pliancy? So it says, to get pliancy, we need continuous joyous effort, taking delight in the practice. So we have to have joyous effort to keep practicing until we get pliancy. And to get this joyous effort, we need aspiration to attain calm abiding. We have to see that calm abiding is a worthwhile goal to work towards so that we're, you know, willing to put in the energy to reach it. And in order to get this aspiration, the cause of that is faith in the good qualities of concentration. And that comes about by just contemplating the benefits that we will get if we achieve calm abiding. Okay, so they include things like happiness in this lifetime, physical and mental bliss and happiness here and now, plus it's an important factor for the attainment of higher goals, liberation, enlightenment, and all the realizations that we need along the way. And with calm abiding, we'll be able to easily focus ourselves on what is virtuous and avoid what is non-virtuous. So those are some of the benefits of calm abiding. So we contemplate those and we get excited. Wow, I really want that. I really want calm abiding. Okay, so the faith in calm abiding leads to aspiration, wanting to get it, and that will lead to joyous effort. And then you put in your joyous effort, you work hard. I mean, it takes time. You can't expect it to happen in a couple of days or months, but if you keep trying your best to achieve calm abiding, eventually you will. And with that, then you will have this pliancy, physical and mental pliancy and bliss, where you have no more laziness and you have all the other benefits of calm abiding. So So you need so all of these are virtuous mental factors. Well, not all of them actually. Faith is a virtuous mental factor. Aspiration is an object ascertaining mental factor, but it could be virtuous if we're doing it for the right reason. Then joyous effort, and then we reach pliancy. So it just shows how these different mental factors come to play to the attainment of pliancy. So I think to be able to experience pliancy, we have to practice calm abiding. I don't know if it's experienced in other contexts. You know, people talk about the zone, isn't it? When they're running or they're focusing on something that they really enjoy doing and they just get into this state of mind where, I don't know if I've experienced it myself, but it's like really peaceful and calm and blissful, and you feel like you could just keep going for a long time and, you know, don't get tired, don't get bored. Yeah? Yeah. Do you think it's at all similar to what we're talking about, like in the development of calm abiding, concentration, pliancy? No?
I used to be able to do things for hours, so I've experienced this a number of times and it doesn't remind me of meditation. Maybe the similarity is the ease. There's a feeling of ease and of a kind of relaxed focus that is kind of effortless, and like everything's falling together in a very without effort. Like if you're playing basketball and it's like that, it's like you're in the flow, nothing's impeding you, and you just go. Or if you're running, or I've played sports where you ran a lot or run a lot. There's maybe similar adjectives, but it's so physical related, and it would be hard for me to separate that.
Also, pliancy is necessarily a virtuous mental factor. Yeah. So in these other kind of situations, it may not be really a virtuous motivation involved for doing these things.
Yeah. I think it's mostly, there's a lack of hindrances occurring at that time. You don't have any feeling of physical hindrances, mental hindrances, emotional hindrances, and you're just completely kind of in the flow of what you're doing without any hindrances.
It sounds similar. That's what they do say.
That part sounds similar, but I can't say I would relate the experiences at all.
The heart rate is very different. The heart rate must be different.
Yeah, your heart is going.
Your
heart is going, but you're in such good shape that it's not an issue. You're completely conditioned to this, so there's no effort. It's kind of like if you have a car, and you have your car on
cruise
control, in a way.
Yeah, I don't know. I have enough experience of that, but I think concentration. You know, when we are concentrating on something, I think that naturally brings some ease of we don't really have to exert ourselves or make a lot of effort. It just becomes really easy, and you can forget about time and forget about eating, and, you know, you're just really there with what you're doing. But if what you're doing is something unwholesome or non-virtuous, then, you know, that's not good. But, you know, with work or with painting, you know, people paint or do artwork or woodwork or whatever, they can get really into what they're doing. It may not be wholesome, may not be unwholesome, maybe just more neutral. But I'm just saying it. We may all, if we look at our experience, we may all have something similar to this that we can relate to. But in Buddhism, what we're trying to do is, you know, cultivate concentration and these other mental factors for a good purpose, for the attainment of higher goals, especially enlightenment, to help all living beings, and not just to win a marathon or paint a beautiful picture or make a beautiful cabinet or whatever, something higher than just worldly, mundane goals. Okay. Okay, the next one, conscientiousness. Okay, this values the accumulation of virtue and guards the mind against that which gives rise to afflictions. It brings to fulfillment and maintains all that is good, keeps the mind from pollution. And when we talk about pollution here, it doesn't mean like air pollution. It means pollution refers to what comes from afflictions and karma. Karma and afflictions, and is the root for attaining all grounds and paths. So this word in English, conscientiousness, or, you know, we talk about somebody being conscientious, it usually means they're doing their job well, thoroughly, you know, in a proper way. For example, a conscientious parent or a conscientious employee, they're fulfilling their responsibilities, they're reliable. But I don't know if that word would be applied to somebody who's doing something non-virtuous, like a conscientious burglar, a conscientious terrorist, doing their job well, possibly. But in Buddhism, it's only applied to virtuous things, doing virtuous things. Okay, so Geshe Rabten says a little bit more about it. He says, it's a distinct mental factor that cherishes the accumulation of what is wholesome and guards the mind against that which gives rise to affliction. It is a quality ascribed to a state of mind in which the three nons, non-attachment, non-hatred, and non-confusion, and joyous effort are present. So when you have conscientiousness, you have all those four mental factors, joyous effort, and then the three nons. So it's not the same as joyous effort. It sounds a little bit similar, but it's, something different. It performs the function of bringing to fulfillment and forever maintaining all that is both good within and beyond this world. Afflictions can arise both from internal as well as external conditions. You know, like if somebody yells at us, it's, of course, we wouldn't get upset about that if we didn't have the seeds of affliction inside of us, but still there are external conditions that can trigger those off. Conscientiousness protects us from reacting in a negative way towards external conditions, and thus prevents the mind from being overwhelmed by attachment, hatred, and so forth. So even if somebody yells at you or does something really annoying or hurtful, if you're conscientious, if you have conscientiousness, you will, you know, remember the teachings you've learned, the practices that you cherish, and will try your best to not just react to a knee-jerk kind of reaction and just yell back or do something hurtful back to that person. But you'll really try to do your best to keep to your values, to your precepts, to your practices, and respond in a wholesome way, not a negative way. In guarding the mind, it is similar in some ways to self-respect or integrity and consideration for others, except that it is not based on a particular reason. Rather, it is a more fundamental protective quality. So integrity is when we refrain from doing something unwholesome by considering ourselves, you know, just like self-respect. I couldn't do such a thing. I wouldn't feel good about myself if I did such a thing. And consideration for others is refraining from non-virtue because of thinking for others, thinking about others. So with conscientiousness, there's not necessarily a particular reason for why we refrain from non-virtue or do virtue, but it's more a protective thing. However much we try to develop wholesome and positive qualities, we will not succeed if we lack the quality of conscientiousness. Living an unconscientious existence is comparable to being spiritually dead. That's pretty heavy. since any opportunity for cultivating virtue is automatically squandered. Living with conscientiousness, though, is equivalent to having found immortality. And there's a footnote saying that this idea is found both in the Dhammapada and in Nagarjuna's letter, friendly letter, letter to the king. Is it two different texts? Friendly letter. And then it says there's four kinds of conscientiousness. Conscientiousness in accumulating merit, conscientiousness in the attainment of liberation, conscientiousness in developing renunciation, and conscientiousness in cultivating uncontaminated virtue. So to cultivate this one, any ideas? And it sounds to me that if we cultivate those other qualities, the three nons, non-attachment, like really working on decreasing our attachment, and developing the opposite of attachment, and then non-hatred or love, and non-confusion, having a clear state of mind, and joyous effort. If we work on cultivating those four, then naturally, it sounds like naturally, conscientiousness will arise, will be there. That's my guess.
Also, I think an awareness of how our values and our precepts and such lead us in the right direction will help foster this trait.
Because it'll help,
help to cultivate this trait because we see that our values lead us in the right direction and that not following them doesn't. It helps. If we have a determination to stick to those values and those precepts and such, then we essentially are cultivating this.
Yeah. Probably most of us learned Buddhism when we were already adults, and we probably went down lots of other paths before. So we know what happens if we go this direction and that direction. And, you know, we've had plenty of disasters and mistakes. So, I think it's then when we find Buddhism and learn it and practice it for a while, we feel like, yeah, this is taking us in a really good direction, really wholesome, positive. So that probably helps us to have greater conscientiousness. We've already known what happens if we don't go this way. We go down some other track.
I found that the weekly or biweekly confession and repentance at the Posada that we do, it really sets my mind in a certain direction. And I have to be mindful of what I'm doing in between that time so that I can sort of come with something to confess. I mean, I do non-virtuous things all the time, but just knowing that there's that opportunity coming up to confess them, I'm more mindful of it. And sometimes I can really feel like the force of virtue kind of steering my mind during that process, because sometimes I think, oh, you know, why not to do this? And it's nobody's business and things like that. But just that group energy and, you know, going before an amenza tester, going before the Sangha, confessing, it really has quite an impact on raising conscientiousness.
Mm. Yeah, in the Tibetan tradition, they don't usually confess one-to-one. Everyone just goes to Sojong and then you just recite all the prayers together. So I think I find it really wonderful to have this opportunity to speak to other Sangha superiors and equals and so forth and just confess, this is what I've done. It's more powerful than just doing it to a whole group, everyone doing it on their own.
Sometimes I like to be conscientious of the fact that so many thousands of people have benefited from Buddha Dharma in the past, if I keep working at it, then I can also increase my qualities and try to, try aiming at perfecting virtue. Keep aiming at trying to perfect virtue, rather.
Yeah, that's like the Sangha. The Sangha is a term for all the followers of the Buddha, both those who are living now, but also in the past. And that's a beautiful thought to think that, yeah, thousands or maybe millions of people have been learning and studying and practicing the Buddha's teachings and keeping them alive, benefiting themselves, benefiting others, and keeping those teachings alive. So, yeah, it gives a kind of strength. And yeah, if we were all by ourselves just trying to read from books or, you know, practice all by ourselves, it would be much harder.
So in general, yeah, goes a little bit into that direction. What Van Makunga said is, for example, when as a Buddhist practitioner, being conscientious how we act in the world, as a monastic, how we appear, as you know, that we keep our precepts well. So to have in mind also the interdependence, the dependency too, that everything has an effect.
So the next one on the list is non-harmfulness, also called non-cruelty. So this is compassion. This is where we find compassion in the virtuous mental practice. So lacking any intention to cause harm, it wishes all sentient beings to be free from suffering. It prevents disrespecting or harming others and increases the wish to benefit and bring them happiness. So here it says it wishes all sentient beings to be free from suffering, but I wonder if even if you can't manage to feel this way towards all sentient beings, you're still working towards that. I think it could still be called non-harmfulness or compassion. Bishop Repton says, he calls it non-violence. Non-violence is a distinct mental factor that, lacking any intention to cause harm, considers if only sentient beings were separated from suffering. It has the function of being unable to bear the suffering of others. In other words, nonviolence is equivalent to compassion, the pure wish that others may be free from suffering. Furthermore, it acts as a foundation for the strong urge not to disrespect others by killing and hurting them, and for the desire to benefit and bring happiness to the weak. So I think, like Buddhist ethics in Buddhism is really based on this. It's really based on understanding that nobody wants to suffer, just as we don't want to suffer, nobody wants to suffer. And respecting that, respecting sentient beings' wish to not suffer and their right to not suffer. And then trying to live our life in a way that we really try not to cause any suffering to others and instead help them as much as we can. So to really practice ethics in Buddhism, we need this quality. And then he explains three kinds of nonviolence, which are the three kinds of compassion we were looking at in the Thursday teachings. Compassion referring to sentient beings, compassion observing phenomena, and the non-referential, or what do we call it, non-apprehendable. Anyway, the one that's combined with emptiness, realization of emptiness. So we spent quite a bit of time talking about those three, so I think we should know them. And, so I think we know a lot about compassion, at least intellectually, and how to cultivate it. There's lots of methods for cultivating compassion. And again, you know, just living in our precepts, you know, taking precepts and living in our precepts just kind of forces us to be mindful of other beings and act in ways that are not harmful for them. And living in a community like this, where compassion is so much a part of the life, you know, being really careful about all the animals and insects and birds and so forth, taking care of them, not harming them, helping them if they do get injured and so on. So it's living in a very compassionate community like this is very, very helpful. And then, of course, in our practices, starting every day with a motivation to do as much as we can to not harm others and to help others and so on, and reminding ourselves of that throughout the day. So we have plenty of opportunities here to increase our compassion. And we have His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who's like just the embodiment of compassion in his life. Just an amazing being. So we're really fortunate to have all these opportunities to work on increasing our compassion. Okay, so the last one, actually, the way the order in this book, The Foundation of, what's it called? The Foundation of Buddhism? Foundation of Buddhist Practice, yeah, from where I'm taking this. The order of the last two is reversed from the normal one. Usually equanimity comes first and then non-harmfulness. But anyway, I don't know if it matters. Okay, so the number 11 is equanimity. Upekkha. Where's Upekkha? Okay, you got to listen to this one, Upekkha. You got to work on this one. Okay, so equanimity does not allow the mind to be greatly affected by agitation and laxity without having to exert great effort to prevent them. So it's actually different kinds of equanimity. In the Tibetan tradition, they mention three. The word equanimity has three meanings. One is, for example, in immeasurable equanimity, the four immeasurables. So one of those is equanimity. And then another meaning of equanimity is in the feeling, the mental factor feeling. So there's three types of feeling: pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. Neutral feeling is also sometimes called equanimity. So that's another way the term is used. But here, this is its own mental factor. Okay, this is specific mental factor, and it comes in calm abiding, in the development of calm abiding. So that's why here it's talking about how it's a balanced state of mind, such that the mind is not affected by the two main hindrances to the development of calm abiding. Here it's called agitation. Sometimes it's called excitement. It's when the mind is crazy, running all over the place, not focused on the object. And the other is laxity, sometimes called dullness, sinking. That's when the mind is kind of sunk into a dull, unclear state. So equanimity is when the mind is not affected by these two faults and enables the mind to stay focused on its object. So it says it enables the mind to settle and remain on a virtuous object and is important for the development of serenity, calm abiding. So this equanimity differs from the equanimity of the four immeasurables and the equanimity that is a neutral feeling. So I don't know, you know, if we're not practicing calm abiding, if we have this one in a manifest state, maybe it's in a seed form, but manifest. Anyway, let's see what Geshe Repton says. Equanimity is a distinct mental factor that, without having to exert a great effort to prevent excitement and sinking, does not let the mind be affected by them. It is a quality ascribed to a state of mind in which the three nons, non-attachment, non-hatred, non-confusion, and enthusiasm are present, joyful effort. It has the function of settling and leaving the mind in rest upon a wholesome object. So it comes into play when we're concentrating. And usually it's not talked about until the higher stages of calm abiding. From usually the eighth and ninth stage of calm abiding, that's when equanimity is there. Furthermore, since the knowledge of ultimate reality only occurs when the mind is in a state of equipoise, equanimity is said to act as a basis for such knowledge. So we need it to develop wisdom realizing emptiness. In addition, it acts as a basis for the prevention of excitement and sinking, as well as all the other root and secondary afflictions. Although it may be weak in an untrained mind, through the practice of constant meditation, it can be developed into a very powerful force. And he says there's three types of equanimity. In this type of equanimity, it can be divided into three. The equanimity of a balanced mind, meaning with exertion, one is able to maintain an equipoise, but otherwise is still subject to being interrupted by slight excitement and sinking. So I was looking at the nine stages, and it sounds like this may occur on the seventh stage. So you still have some sinking and excitement, and you need not a whole lot, but you do need to make some effort to subdue them, to manage them. And the second equanimity is a mind at rest, is able to concentrate on its object without having to make any great effort to apply the remedies for excitement and sinking. So that sounds like on the eighth stage. It says right at the beginning of your session, you need to make a little bit of effort to settle your mind, but then the rest of the time your mind is just a single flow of concentration, no need to make any effort. And then the third is the equanimity of a spontaneous mind. This occurs when the mind is finally equipoised in concentration. It is a state in which, even without any effort, excitement and sinking will definitely not occur. So that sounds like on the ninth stage. I'm just guessing, okay, but he doesn't mention where these occur, but it sounds like on the ninth stage, there's no need to make any effort. Excitement and sinking just don't occur. Don't disturb your mind. So how can we develop this one? Yeah, every year you have a retreat to calm abiding. But in between, you know, even on a daily basis, one can even just 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, whatever you can manage, just trying to keep the mind focused and bring the mind back when it wanders away. So in that way, we're familiarizing our mind with that state of being focused, and then looking out for sinking, dull, dark state of mind, brightening the mind to counteract that, and then looking out for excitement, mind running off to objects of attachment, and then counteracting that, bringing the mind back, trying to deal with the attachment. So even just making a little bit of effort, whatever we can, to cultivate the antidotes to these disturbances to calm abiding and training our mind to have calm abiding. So this way we're building up the causes to have equanimity eventually. It seems that in the Pali tradition there's even more meanings of equanimity. I was looking at volume 4, I think. And it mentioned Buddha Dasa in the Visuddhimagga mentions 10 different kinds of equanimity. She doesn't mention all of them in the book, only 6. But, you know, I often, you hear sometimes from people who are more familiar with the Theravada tradition, they talk about equanimity in the sense of not having attachment or aversion. Yeah, so that's one of the types of equanimity mentioned by Buddhadasa. It's not mentioned in our tradition. I haven't come across it in our tradition. It's not quite the same as this one here. But that's specifically for sentient beings, for sentient beings. But they don't, in our tradition, I haven't come across it being talked about with regard to other things, you know, like sounds or smells or taste. So I think in the Theravada tradition they do, when you're practicing mindfulness, you try to watch out for the mind having attachment, reacting with attachment to one type of object and aversion to another type of object, and just trying to not follow those tendencies and instead have an equanimous state of mind, neither attached nor aversion. Yeah, it is similar to the immeasurable equanimity which we develop with regard to people. We try not to have attachment to some people and aversion to other people. But they talk about it in a broader way for any kind of object or experience. Venerable Losung?
You mentioned it as the neutral of the three kinds of feelings. But the kind you were just talking about with different objects can also be applied to feelings. Like we can have equanimity towards, or try to develop equanimity towards pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral feelings. I believe a lot of our lack of equanimity towards people and other objects has to do with our lack of equanimity towards those feelings that we associate with them. Oh, I have a bad feeling when I'm around this person, but a good feeling when I'm around that one. So I have an attachment to that one and an aversion to this one.
Mm. Yeah, it could be the feeling of equanimity. I guess I always thought of the feeling of equanimity as something that just arises naturally. It's not something we cultivate. It's just, you know, feelings just arise, you know, spontaneously.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's one of the feelings. I mean, that's the second one, being the neutral feeling. But I'm saying we can have an attitude of equanimity towards the other two feelings.
Oh, yeah.
Not having this strong aversion to an unpleasant feeling or this attachment to a pleasant feeling.
Yeah, I mean, I think we don't have a lot of control over what type of feelings arise in us. You know, they're just so fast. As soon as we smell something unpleasant, you know, there's an unpleasant feeling, or pleasant smell, a pleasant feeling. So they just come up so quickly. But we can be aware of those feelings and try not to let our mind go with them, and then develop attachment to the pleasant and aversion to the unpleasant, and instead try to stay in a more balanced state of mind. Neither attachment or aversion. So I think this is something that's practiced and cultivated. And I mean, I think we should be doing it in our tradition, even though it's not necessarily talked about in a very explicit way. But I think it is explained in the Theravada tradition when they're practicing meditation. Just notice the feelings, the experiences, and trying not to follow them in the sense of going with attachment, going with aversion.
Yeah, Buddha taught that.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. So that's just kind of a quick look at these 11 virtuous mental factors. And then the handout that I sent today, yeah, I included some information from this text. You already have that text, but I just thought it might be easier to extract it. This text called A Necklace for Those of Good Fortune. This is the text about mind and mental factors. So it contained this explanation of virtue and non-virtue, which I think is quite precious, because there's so much talk about virtue and non-virtue, how we should try to practice virtue and not non-virtue. But it's not always easy to find clear explanation of what is virtue and what is non-virtue. So And so I pulled that out and I thought we could look through this. So at first it goes through virtue, discussion of the category of virtuous mental factors. Qualm. With regard to virtue, are the 11 virtuous mental factors which have been explained here exhaustive? Response. In general, virtues are taught to be of five types. I think some time ago I mentioned in Vasubandhu's Abhidharma Kosha, he mentions four kinds of virtue. So here there's a fifth one. So let's go through these. So the first is virtue by way of entity. And down below it explains what that means. The 11 explained above, faith and so forth, are specified as being virtues by way of entity because they are generated in the entity of virtue from their mere establishment without relying on other factors, such as motivation. So the 11 mental factors that we just went through are virtuous by entity, or we could say maybe naturally virtuous. They are naturally virtuous. That's their nature. They don't need anything else to make them virtuous. So that's virtue by entity, the 11 mental factors. And then the last sentence, he says, hence, here I have indicated the 11 principal virtues. So that seems to indicate there are others. There are other virtuous mental factors, but these are the main ones, the principal ones. So I don't know what the other... Actually, in the Theravada tradition, they have, I think, in their Abhidharma, they have 25... I forgot to look them up. They call them beautiful. 25 beautiful mental factors. It's a nice term. So I think one of them is mindfulness. So that's considered a beautiful mental factor. So anyway, you can look it up on Wikipedia. There's all 25, yeah.
I've puzzled over this a lot since studying these 51 mental factors, and it seems like my guess is that these are mental factors that are, especially the virtuous ones, they're important for developing calm abiding and insight. Liberation, really, is what it's pared down to. It's not that it's exhaustive, but if you look how many of these are antidotes to developing calm abiding or insight, it seems like...
Mm-hmm. Well, I would think just in general, those of us who want to follow the path, practice what the Buddha taught and achieve the results, calm abiding, special insight, and beyond, liberation and so on, these are the main mental factors that we need to know about. The non-virtuous or the afflictive ones we need to get out of the way. The virtuous ones we need to develop. So these are the most important ones, but they're not exhaustive. There are others, but maybe they're less important for our practice. Okay, the second type of virtue is called virtue by way of relation. So these include minds and mental factors that are concomitant by way of the five similarities with the 11, faith and so forth. So mental factors never exist by themselves. You can't have faith all by itself hanging around. Yeah, it always has to come together with a main mind, one of the six types of main minds, mainly, actually, probably only mental consciousness. I don't know. Vasubandhu says you can. He says all the five omnipresent and the five object ascertaining mental factors accompany every consciousness, even eye consciousness, ear consciousness. It sounds a little strange, and I don't think the other schools agree with that, but it's an interesting idea. Our eye consciousness can have faith. I think the other schools don't agree with that. So I think the virtuous mental factors would be together with the mental consciousness, not sense consciousnesses. So there's a mental consciousness, and then whatever other mental factors are together in that package, they all become virtuous by the presence of faith or any of the other virtuous mental factors. The whole group becomes virtuous by way of relation. Third, virtues by way of subsequent relation are imprints of virtue. So this is the one that Vasubandhu doesn't mention. The imprints, I guess that means imprints left by virtue. You know, if we do something virtuous and that leaves karmic imprints in our mind. I guess that's what he's talking about here. That makes sense. We have this virtuous karma, and then that will give rise to positive results in the future. And the fourth, virtues by way of motivation are, for instance, physical and verbal actions motivated by faith. So if we have a virtuous mental factor like faith, compassion, non-hatred, which is love, and so on, and then we do actions motivated by those virtuous mental factors, those actions become virtuous actions, good karma, we would say. So that's another kind of virtue. And the fifth, virtues by way of ultimacy or ultimate virtue are explained to be thusnesses. It's another term for emptinesses, because all obscurations will be purified if one meditates within observation of thusness. Therefore, they are designated as virtues, but are not actual virtues. So Vasubandhu said ultimate virtue was nirvana, but that's pretty much the same. Nirvana is true cessation, and in the higher schools, they do say true cessation is emptiness. Emptiness is true cessation. So anyway, emptiness, true cessation, nirvana, those would be ultimate virtues. But they're not actual virtues. Any idea why? Not karma. Is that what you said? Well, virtuous mental factors aren't karma. But not all the others are consciousness either. Imprints are not consciousness. So it doesn't have to be consciousness.
It's more the object of a virtuous mind rather than
virtuous. Because they're permanent, they can't have, they're permanent phenomena, they don't have an effect, and virtuous necessarily brings a happy result.
Yeah, that's the reason, I think. Because virtue, I haven't really come across a definition of virtue. Like, what is the definition of virtue? I haven't found that. But they do say that virtue is what brings about happiness. It's the cause of happiness. So that indicates it's got to be something impermanent. It's causative, something that will bring results. And things like emptiness and nirvana are not impermanent, they're permanent, so they can't actually have results. So I think that's the reason.
Back a couple, it mentions the five similarities and then says faith and so forth.
Mm.
I feel as if I've missed something.
Yeah, we had those before, five similarities. Anyone remember what they are? So first is the basis or support, meaning they depend on the same sense power, which could be eye sense power, ear sense power, and so on. So there's six different sense powers. So they all arise in dependence on that sense power. And then the second is object of observation, meaning they observe the same object. Okay, so if you have an eye consciousness looking at, you know, a blue object, so the main mind and all the mental factors accompanying it are looking at that same object. And then aspect, third, this is a little hard to understand, but they say that when we have a consciousness, a mind, it arises in the aspect of the object, similar to a reflection appearing in a mirror. When you hold an object in front of a mirror, the mirror will take on a reflection of that. So they say our mind works in a similar way. Our mind takes on like a reflection or an aspect of the object that we perceive. So we're looking at a blue object, the mind takes on the aspect of blue. And so the main mind and all the mental factors accompanying it will also arise in that same aspect as blue or whatever the object is. Third, fourth one is time. They all arise together, abide together, and cease together. The fifth is substance, which is a little hard to understand, but they say that there's only one main mind at a time, and there can only be one of each type of mental factor at a time. Like feeling is an ever-present mental factor. So you can never have more than one feeling at a time. Only one feeling will accompany one main mind. And the same with the other mental factors. So there's consistency there in numbers. Does that make sense? No, but it's saying with one main mind, you can only have one mental factor of a type, like a feeling. You can't have two feelings with one main mind, but you can, according to some scholars, you can't have two main minds at the same time. And each of those main minds would have their own group, their own retinue. They use the word retinue of mental factors. So you could have two feelings at the same time, but they're part of different main minds, not the same mind. Does that make sense? Well, I was kind of hoping to go on two more, but yeah, we're kind of, it was over ambitious. Well, maybe we have time to go through the non-virtues. We could go through the non-virtues. Yeah, your question.
Sorry, since we backed up here and I missed your teaching on the five omnipresent mental factors, so I'm sorry if you've covered this before. You know, when it says that they arise, abide, and cease simultaneously, so then contact and feeling would be simultaneous, but the feeling would be the feeling produced by the previous moment of
because
contact?
Cause always has to precede effect. So let me see, what does it say about that? I don't know if I put it in here, but yeah, feeling arises from contact. Yeah, so if we look under contact, it says contact connects object, cognitive faculty, and primary consciousness, thereby acting as a basis for the feeling. So the contact of one moment would give rise to the feeling of the next moment, because it's the cause of feeling. But how that actually works, I've always found contact difficult to figure out. I mean, I can understand those three things have to come together, but to say it's a mental factor that brings them together, I don't know. It's hard to figure that one out. That's my experience. So do you want to just go through those the non-virtues? Yeah. It's kind of similar. It's just the opposite, the reverse of it, of the virtues. So similarly, non-virtues are also taught to be of five types. So we're back to the handout that you got today. Okay, so there's non-virtues by way of entity, relation, subsequent relation, motivation, and ultimacy. So non-virtues by way of entity are mostly the root afflictions and the secondary afflictions. So, because I was hoping to start talking about the afflictions tonight, but it's kind of curious that, you know, we just had this group of 11 virtuous mental factors, and then you would kind of think the next group should be the non-virtuous mental factors, right? But they're not called the non-virtuous mental factors. They're called afflictions. So the thing is, the afflictions are not necessarily non-virtuous. They're not always non-virtuous. There are cases in which they're not non-virtuous. They're not virtuous. Well, actually, in the Dalai Lama's book, I was going to go through that. I pulled out some material from Volume 3, if you want to look it up on your own. Or it's in the handout here, if you want to read down. It's in Volume 3, pages 66 to 69. Where he's talking about, he's going through the Four Noble Truths. The second noble truth is the truth of the origin. So he goes through the six root afflictions in there. First is attachment. And he talks about cases of attachment that are not non-virtuous, and that are even virtuous, believe it or not. He said, like, you know, craving, if you have craving for good rebirths, you know, you want to be born in a good place in your next life. It could be a kind of attachment, but it motivates you to do virtue. Because you know, I mean, if you know your stuff, you know you have to create virtue in order to have that good rebirth. So that craving becomes a motivating factor for virtuous actions, refraining from killing and so forth, practicing non-killing. So because it motivates virtue and it leads to a good result, at least within samsara, happiness of samsara, then it's virtuous. So anyway, the point is that not all of the six root afflictions and 20 secondary afflictions are necessarily non-virtuous. So that's why it's really good to know what is virtue, what is non-virtue. Then you can, it's like I realize there's four possibilities between attachment and non-virtue. Something which is attachment and not non-virtue, something which is non-virtue, non-attachment, and so on. But maybe next time, whenever we have a chance to come together, we can go through that. So anyway, I think that's why it says here, non-virtues by way of entity are mostly the root afflictions and the secondary non-afflictions. Probably in most cases, the root and secondary afflictions are non-virtuous, but not necessarily. Another example is ignorance or grasping at self. That can also motivate us to engage in virtue. We want a good rebirth in our next life. We want happiness within samsara. Then that will, you know, get us to engage in virtue. Number two, non-virtues by way of relation are the minds and the mental factors that are concomitant with those afflictions. So if you have anger in your mind, that's always non-virtuous. anger in the mind, the main mind and all the other mental factors together with it in that group, they all become non-virtuous. Yeah, because, in this section from volume 3, he did say that. He did say anger is never virtuous. But then I was wondering about this woman who got angry about the landmines and did all this work to get rid of landmines. And that was virtuous. She probably saved a lot of lives, protected a lot of people from horrible suffering and injuries and so on. But maybe what we could say there is the initial motivation was anger about the landmines, but then compassion kicked in. And there's probably compassion there right from the beginning as well. Compassion for the victims, the people who were injured by these landmines. And so instead of just going and behaving in a destructive way, full-blown anger, we want to hurt, we want to harm, we want to destroy, we want to do bad things. So instead of doing bad things with her emotions, she did constructive things, good things. Yeah. So we could perhaps say that it wasn't really the anger that motivated the good actions, but the compassion, maybe. But also I wonder if maybe this statement that he made here was made long ago. And it seems to be more in recent years that His Holiness is making these other statements about how anger isn't always negative, isn't always bad. It's kind of revolutionary. Revolutionary! Yeah, I'll send you an article. There's actually this article I found on the internet about this, and it's pretty interesting.
Can I ask a follow-up question about that?
Yeah.
So when we get into the 10... Well, there's six root afflictions, right? Is that what they're called? Six root afflictions.
Root afflictions,
and,
yeah.
Okay, and that is what is. I guess I always thought that always. I have thought in the past that the caveat was for the afflicted views, not so much for the five views. But it sounds like you're.
You mean the non-views.
Yeah,
the five non-views, attachment, anger, and so on. Mm-hmm.
That those were necessarily disturbing emotions in this list of 51 mental factors.
Well, they are disturbing emotions because the meaning of an affliction, you know, the definition of affliction is something that disturbs the mind. They do disturb the mind. They cause the mind to be unpeaceful. And also, if our goal is liberation, we want to get out of samsara, we want to get to enlightenment, we definitely have to get rid of them. They're definitely obstacles to those goals. But within samsara, while we're still circling in samsara, they're not always harmful.
I thought there were three possibilities between afflictions and afflictive emotions.
Well, what do you mean by afflictive emotion?
What term are you using? would be something like anger, attachment, pride.
Well, I think it's a question of translation, because they only have one term, nyunmong in Tibetan, or klesha. Yeah. And some translate it as affliction, some translate it as afflictive emotion.
His Holiness makes a distinction between afflictions and afflictive emotions. It's described there in terms of disturbing emotions and views. Let's take a look at it.
Yeah, well, also in this section, I didn't copy it here. Yeah, in this section in volume 3, that's in my notes. I'm a little disorganized tonight. He did say that afflictions, these six root afflictions, could be emotions or attitudes or views. Emotion would be something like anger. But I think in Tibetan they just have one term for all of them. Nyunmong. And then it's different translators who are trying to find terms. Actually, I like the word delusion. For me, that word just works for all of them. They're all delusions because they all see things in a mistaken way. But the word affliction, I don't like the word affliction, because affliction doesn't necessarily have to be a mind. It could be a sickness. It could be a natural disaster. It could be war. So delusion, I think, is a much better translation, because it's always a mind, and it's erroneous. It's seeing things in a mistaken way, and that's such a perfect description for these states of mind. Anyway, so that's my choice. Or some say mental afflictions. You know, to make it clear, we're not talking about diseases or plagues or natural disasters, mental afflictions, but then that becomes so long. Delusions is kind of short and sweet.
Mental affliction makes it clear that it's painful for us.
And that it's mental. It's a state of mind rather than something.
The word affliction makes it clear that it's a suffering.
Yeah. And that is the criteria, that is one of the features of an affliction, of a delusion. It disturbs us, it's unpeaceful, it's painful, it doesn't bring happiness. Let's just finish looking at the non-virtues, the different kinds of non-virtue. Okay, relation, then subsequent relation or imprints of non-virtue. So I guess that would be like the karmic imprints after we've done a non-virtuous action. So that's also non-virtuous. And then non-virtuous by way of motivation. These are the actions, physical actions and verbal actions that we do motivated by affliction. So when we get angry and then we act it out with our words, with our action. So that would be non-virtuous actions. And then the last one is ultimate non-virtue, and that is cyclic existence and whatever is included in cyclic existence. And they are the source, it says, since these are the sources from which superiors generate despondency or renunciation, they want to get away from, they are called non-virtues by way of ultimacy. Nonetheless, it is not definite that everything included in cyclic existence is an actual non-virtue. I forget what might be something included in samsara but isn't non-virtue.
Virtues.
Well, this table is included in samsara, but it's not non-virtue. I think that would be an example. And our bodies. How about our bodies? Are our bodies non-virtue? What about cessations? Those are virtue. You mean cessations of delusions?
Well, you're in samsara and you're having cessations. Those cessations would not be non-virtue, would be virtuous. Would
They're
be,
virtuous.
Would not be
but they wouldn't be in samsara. They wouldn't be
That's
included
what I'm saying.
In samsara. Yeah. No, but it's saying here, not everything included in samsara is an actual non-virtue.
So aren't you're in samsara and you're having cessations. You're not an arhat yet, and you're having cessations. You're not even an arya yet. Well, maybe that's not okay. Do all your cessations have to be related to emptiness? I guess they do.
Cessations are related to afflictions, delusions. A cessation is the absence of a delusion such that it will never arise again.
Okay, so then you have to be an arya.
Yeah.
And an arya is still in cyclic existence.
Bodhisattva aryas. I don't know. There's different opinions about that.
Okay.
Bodhisattva aryas. I don't know.
I thought you have to get to the eighth ground before you're there, but let's say in the Tara.
I'll look it up. There, I just went through this in the Pramana course, and there is a difference between saying included in samsara and samsara.
Okay.
And they have different these technical terms, so I'll look it up, and I don't know when I'll let you know. I can.
Someone brought up the paths and grounds, and when you're first cultivating bodhicitta on the first and second. Anyway, when you first cultivate bodhicitta, you're still in samsara. That's not for non-virtuous.
The bodhicitta of a bodhisattva, a brand new bodhisattva.
Yeah, but before they're an arya being.
It's still contaminated.
Yeah, it would be contaminated because that person hasn't yet directly realized emptiness and hasn't eliminated any of their afflictions. So it's a very virtuous state of mind, the bodhicitta. Anyway, I'll let you know what the answer is. What is the meaning of this term included in cyclic? It's kind of complicated, but my mind is leaky these days. I can't remember everything.
Yeah, and how do the two compare? Non-virtuous and contaminated. They're not mutually inclusive, are they?
No. Something could be contaminated. But not non-virtuous, like virtue. We talk about contaminated virtue.
Okay.
When we contaminated means you still have ignorance, you still see things as inherently existing.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, for example, when we're creating virtue, we're doing our prostrations and our purification and our meditation and so on. This is virtuous, but it's still contaminated because, yeah. Yeah, we're going to be contaminated for a long time.
Yeah.
But don't get depressed about that. Because at least we have the tools. We have the tools, and we're getting ourselves out. Yeah, it's kind of a long time. It's not until you're an arya that you can really create uncontaminated virtue.
Yeah, I was thinking more about that in terms of when they say a table is a contaminated phenomenon because it can generate affliction. I mean, it can be the object of observation of an affliction.
Right? Also, it comes from karma and afflictions. Mm-hmm. Where does this, you know, the things in samsara, even the environment and tables and chairs and so on, the source of these, the origin of these is the karma and afflictions of sentient beings. So they too are contaminated and part of samsara. Yeah, but yeah, we have to keep ourselves positive. And we can get out. The Buddha did it. Lots of others did it. We can get out too. It's not permanent. It's not forever. But yeah, I mean, it is. I think it's really good to know exactly what is virtue and what is non-virtue and the different types of each one. because we do have the chance to create, you know, to develop virtuous mental factors and create virtuous karma. And I mean, that's so fortunate. Like, so many people in the world don't know how to do that, or they have wrong ideas about things. What is virtue? What, and they may think they're creating virtue, but actually they're creating non-virtue. So we're very fortunate to have access to these teachings. So if we have a chance sometime later, we can continue looking through these. There was this really interesting section on attachment, and you can read through it on the handout, but it is from volume 3, so you have a copy of volume 3, you can look it up.